Welcome to Unceded Airwaves. My name is Danny. I'm our Indigenous Collective Lead here at CITR 101.9 FM. I couldn't be present for the interview, but our collective did an amazing job. Francis, Cooper, and Jazz facilitated the interview with the lovely Angela Sterrett.
Hi, I'm Jazz, and you'll be hearing me throughout the interview with Angela Sterrett. We were super honored that she came in person to speak with us. She also joined us in our FNIS 220 class with Dr. Candace Callison. So she was on campus, and we were lucky enough that she agreed to join us here as well. We talked a bit about her experience at CBC as a former journalist and podcast host, and also about her book, Unbroken, which is super powerful. Her book is super personal, and she draws on the experiences of herself and of Indigenous women. Yeah, she covers a lot of heavy topics. But we decided to start the interview by asking her what she finds to be the most fulfilling in her work. And she was also working for CBC for over 10 years. So we decided to also ask her how she felt as a Gitxsan Indigenous woman working for CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which is colonial corporation. Really kind of thought-provoking to hear her answers to those questions. She ended her book on a really positive note too. We decided to highlight that as well. But yeah, it was a really cool talk.
After these few ads, we'll get ready to jump into our interview with Angela Sterrett.
Is your mom obsessed with Vicks Vapor Rub?
So is ours.
Are you too obsessed with Vicks Vapor Rub?
So are we.
Tune in to Viva Poru, el ungüento para el alma, every other Thursday at 4 p.m. here at CITR 101.9 FM.
A radio show dedicated to Latin awesomeness and culture. Hosted by yours truly, the one and only
DJ Bruja. And the other one and only
DJ D-Rod.
Featuring music genres like
salsa, sabrosura vintage, bolero, bossa, Latin indie, plus so much more.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
It's Nardwar, the human serviette, and you're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM.
We have been called the Indians.
Justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
The virus took on many shapes. The bear, the elk, the antelope.
Jasmine Andrew. My name's Jasmine. I'm from the Liwat Nation, part of the Stotliam Nation.
Hello, my name is Francis. I am half Mexican and then half Uruguayan, Romanian, Brazilian, and European settler colonial. And I am an ally. And very mixed, very mixed.
Hey, it's MC Kenzie on the mic. I'm a settler here on Musqueam-Tsleil-Waututh Squamish land. I'm Anglo-Indian and Scottish, and my baby sisters are part of the Squamish Nation, so topics regarding Indigenous rights really hit close to home for me.
We're joining you here from the unceded and ancestral territory of the Hunkaminam and Squamish-speaking peoples, the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
Simgigetsigidim ha nach gantkabuluksit luam godi wingesam atamasatun wea. Angela Sterrett, Lu Algia Tum Kbist. So my name is Angela Sterrett. My Gixan name is Lu Algia Tum Kbist, which means woman who works in television and radio, which is always funny because I no longer do that as of September. I quit my job at CBC in September. And yeah, and so I am Gixan on my father's side. My grandfather was groomed most of his life to be the hereditary chief of Uigach, the house of the Big Wings, and he said no to that role because it's a big role. And my uncle, Neil Sterrett, took that role until he passed away at the young age of 107 a couple of years ago.
That's
yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
And my mom is white, so on my mother's side, she is Irish and English from the Isles of Jersey. And I also have Irish on my father's side. So when I speak about white people, I don't just have a friend that's white. I am actually mostly white.
So we are here this afternoon with Angela Sterrett, a multi-platform journalist, reporter, and author from the Gitxsan Nation. In 2023, Sterrett published the book Unbroken. Jazz is going to give a little bit more info on that.
In 2023, Sterrett published the book Unbroken, My Fight for Survival, Hope, and Justice for Indigenous Women and Girls. This book blends investigative reporting with stories on missing and murdered Indigenous women, drawing on personal memoirs about her own experiences as an Indigenous woman. This book is so incredibly powerful and was shortlisted finalist for the Hillary Weston Writers Trust Prize for Nonfiction and for the Governor General's Award for English Language Nonfiction at the 2023 Governor General's Awards.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the book, a little bit about CBC, and then a little bit of just like general questions that we'd love to ask you within the time frame that we have.
One of our first questions that we thought we would ask you is, what do you find to be the most fulfilling in your work?
So I no longer am at CBC now. I mostly do talks. I am, I guess, a motivational speaker. Mm-hmm. And I love walking into the room and people are happy to see me and are motivated by what I'm saying. I mean, I was a journalist, a full-time permanent TV, radio, and digital reporter since 2010, but I'd been with the CBC since 2004, on and off. And I just loved telling stories, you know, primarily about Indigenous people. I loved telling the truth. You know, when I first began, there was a lot of resistance and a lot of gaslighting around telling our stories. It was very difficult to tell the truth of Indigenous people, which is, you know, kind of goes up against the purpose of journalism, which is telling the truth from many different perspectives. And I just love talking to people, learning about their stories, getting to the truth of it. I also really loved the modality or the mode or the medium. Like, I loved the technical elements of radio, of television. It can be very artistic. But I think for the most part, it was telling the truth in a nation that doesn't want to hear the truth, right? Especially right now, there's a ton of denialism going on. There's a ton of gaslighting of Indigenous people. I often call it Gaslight Nation. And so there's such a resistance, and it's such an important time to speak the truth and to have active listening. But there's such a resistance to do so, I think, from the public. So, yeah, I loved telling stories. I have not done so since September. I was extremely burnt out from the entire system, the colonial system of mainstream media.
Yeah.
So understandable.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Yeah, something that you emphasize in your book too that I thought was important to share is that, like, you really were like, Indigenous peoples need to tell Indigenous peoples' stories. Like, we can't have other people telling our stories for us.
Yeah, and we've been doing that for so long, right? I think when I first moved back to Vancouver, I was stationed in Yellowknife, and then I was in Toronto, and then I was in Winnipeg, and I really had such high expectations for coming back to this territory and really believed that people, you know, not only wanted to hear the truth, but that people were on some sort of trajectory for transformation. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the first stories that I saw on television when I came back was, yeah, a white anthropologist, a guy telling the stories of the Squamish people of Stanley Park. And I just thought, like, how difficult is it for journalists to find a Squamish person to tell those stories? Mm-hmm. But there's such a deficit of relationship building or a desire to hear those voices from that perspective. And it needs to be done because it's almost like we live in two different worlds when we're hearing from Indigenous people versus white people telling our stories on behalf of us.
Yeah, and I think to speak on it as someone who was raised in Canada's colonial education system with a Canadian identity, Canadian passport, but also being raised alongside Indigenous foster siblings, it messes with your head a bit to see these two realities and have people that just frankly can't even look at them. Like, I think it kind of like blows apart the whole concept of Canadian to be real about what is going on with the Indigenous communities here and the help that they need and the support they deserve from the settler population.
Well, one thing I want to say, though, is that I don't think Indigenous people need any more help, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's so much saviorism that happens and that goes on. And that's the biggest question I always get asked at every talk that I give now is, how can we help? Mm. And it's like, well, maybe you should step back. So when I was doing my Land Back podcast, one of my elders, Ardith Wilson Dimdigibu, said, well, for me, it's not land back, it's get back. Mm. It's get off our land, get off our minds, get off our souls, like, stop telling us how we should be, or stop trying to help us. And there's, you know, whole cottage industries about helping Indigenous people, you know, through the foster care system, through the child welfare system, through the Canadian government. Like, that's colonialism, is telling us that we can't do things ourselves, that we need help, that we are wards of the court, that we are children, essentially, who need protection, when really Indigenous people need to be left alone to focus on rebuilding our cultural institutions, relearning our language, building up our communities, getting our children back, getting our land back, getting our love back. And white people, you know, on my mama's side and my dad's side, we're responsible for fixing those colonial structures. That's what we should be focusing on, is helping ourselves. Mm-hmm. We came here, and a lot of people say, well, I didn't do it. My ancestors didn't do it either. Well, you know, on my white side, we did tacitly consent to what was going on. And our ancestors did build and destroy Indigenous communities. They built their own colonial governments, and they destroyed Indigenous territories, cultural institutions, governments, and that's what white people should be focused on, is dismantling those systems of oppression that continue to tear apart Indigenous people.
Yeah, I agree fully. I also, here at UBC, I study film and sociology. And I've also done some social work classes, and a lot of what we've learned about is in great part, like, systemic unlearning, because there's so many forms of systemic oppression within not just, like, North American Canadian society, but just, like, globally, like, global systemic systems of oppression that just need to be completely dismantled and unlearned. And community plays a really big part in that, in the process of, like, unlearning and replenishing from the perspective and with the voices and the rights. Like, there's so much to do with rights in Canada as well, like, if you look at the history. So I think it's very, yeah, thank you for that, because it's, I think, super important to just remember, like, white saviorism is such a problematic thing that you can see everywhere, not just, like, in everyday, but in media, in, like, schools. Like, it just goes, like, so far back that there's so much unlearning and learning to do simultaneously. So, yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah.
And with CBC, we had some questions regarding CBC. So as an award-winning investigative journalist, you have an extensive catalog of articles published under CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. You hosted Land Back, the six-part series about a podcast about uncovering land theft and land reclamation in Canada. And so our question was two parts. One, with CBC being founded in colonial Canada in 1936, how did you feel being an Indigenous journalist writing and being published on CBC formally? Because you did leave that recently. So that's the first question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of atonement that, you know, colonial media has to create in this country, right? There's a lot that corporate colonial media has to atone for in this country. There's many instances and examples where CBC in particular has not only, you know, for example, upheld stereotypes about Indigenous people, but also been part of promoting colonialism. There's a documentary that CBC did in 1960 that showcased how amazing they thought residential school was, the Kamloops Indian Residential School. That's online. That's publicly available knowledge.
Still published?
It's still online. I think CBC republished it in 2021 when they got called out about it and said, you know, put like a caption underneath it that said, you know, this is, I don't even think they said this is wrong. I'm not sure how they worded it, but they've never said, you know, they've never apologized for upholding that system. There's also a piece that they did on the AIM program. I can't remember what that stands for, but it's basically the like Métis and I think it was adoption for Indian and Métis children, and CBC did a whole piece on how great that program was. It was basically promoting the 60s scoop, right? And then, you know, my career just really trying to tell the truth, right? And being told, well, we can't talk about colonialism because no one knows what that is. We have to do a whole history lesson on that, and it's going to take up the whole, you know, article. It's going to take up, you know, our whole 7 minutes of airtime about this topic. And you can't talk about the 60s scoop because no one knows what it is. We have to explain that. Like, everything has to have such an explanation around it because we're coming to this place of learning. You can't talk about racism because it's really difficult to prove when racism exists. So this really intense pushback of telling the truth and telling it from a perspective, a white perspective, of there's two sides of everything. Well, there's not. There's not two sides of racism. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, I think, you know, after the murder of George Floyd, media was really put to the test. And CBC in particular, as the public broadcaster, supposed to be representative of all Canadians, you know, not just white Canadians, saying, as journalists who are impartial, who, you know, lead our coverage, lead our stories with impartiality, is it okay for us to say racism is wrong? And they were put to the test, the executives at CBC, and they said, well, we're not really sure. They were not able to say that, you know, and there's certain elements of being a journalist that cross with being a human, and being able to call out and say racism is wrong, colonialism is wrong, stealing is wrong, things we learned as children, right? But we still see, we continue to see, you know, it's not like land dispossession happened and then it's over. It's not like taking our children happened and then it's over. Land theft continues to happen on behalf of the Canadian provincial governments. 92% of Canada's land mass is owned by the Crown governments, right? And they continue to go to court to fight Indigenous people to access our lands or to dispossess us of our lands. Our children are still being taken for reasons that white children would never be taken, like very simple poverty reasons that could be alleviated by, instead of giving the money to foster parents, giving that to the actual parents. So there's incredible systemic, fundamental systemic issues that point to the reality that we're living under colonialism today, right? And we see that in, you know, whether it's in Wet'suwet'en territory, whether it's in Haudenosaunee territory, whether it's in Vancouver, in the urban centers, what's happening to Indigenous people. So there's a real pushback of Canadian media to face the facts.
I think a great example of someone's work who does dismantle this and does kind of say, like, I don't care what, like, the producers or publishers or broadcasters ask of me is Alanis Obomsawin. Everything that Alanis does is just incredible. If you haven't familiarized yourself with Alanis's work, you got to get on that.
And she's like, what, 70 years old or 80?
I think
she's
queen.
Like, and she's still making a film. Like, she's made, I don't even know, like hundreds maybe of films. And she's still doing it. Like, just an incredible woman.
Our second part of that question was Cooper, if you wanted to.
I mean, first off, Angela, I just wanted to say thank you for speaking on your experience, because sounds like you face a lot of boundaries entering CBC as an Indigenous journalist. And that stuff isn't easy to do. So really respect for the walls you've had to push across and all the Indigenous girls that will come after you that won't have to take down those things that you did. So really, really big respect to you for that.
Thank you.
For the viewers, for context, Angela has a CBC podcast titled Land Back. In episode one, titled The Eviction, she covers the historic Aboriginal rights and title case where the Gitxsan Nation, her nation, serves an eviction notice to a settler couple building on their land. She goes on to mention the 1993 documentary Blockade, as well as the historical Delgamuukw case, where I believe your uncle testified and your dad spoke often of it, so it sounds like I should face the mic while I speak. It sounds like you, this is really personal for you. And I wanted to pull up a quote from your podcast where you were quoting someone else and you said, basically he said, we were too primitive. We didn't have fences or written language before colonization. We didn't understand the concept of land ownership. So, he said, we just didn't own our land. I was raised within Canada's colonial education system, being taught the names of provinces in elementary without a mention of a native population, complete erasure. When I became a student at UBC and was introduced to land acknowledgements, the concepts of shared territories was new to me. So, Angela, my question for you is, if you think that the immigrants that make up Canada's settler population could be introduced to and adopt a culture that no longer relies on land ownership.
If I think they could adopt a culture that doesn't rely on land ownership?
Yeah, I just noticed, sorry if it doesn't make too much sense, in your quote at the end he says, we just didn't own our land, and for me that fosters like a deep respect for the land that I wasn't necessarily raised with. So I think I'm just curious.
I think there's a difference in understanding of what ownership means, right? So Indigenous people, for us, I think our ownership, it's not to, you know, pillage or to control or to have dominance over it. It's our sovereignty binds our connection to the land to take care of it, our responsibility to the land. So ownership for us means a responsibility to take care of it. And so we have a voluntary hierarchy system, right? In Gitxsan territory, we have hereditary chiefs. We have matriarchs who take care of the land, right? They have the knowledge of the rivers, the salmon, the migration of the elk. And it's incredibly important for us to know who those hereditary chiefs are and what territories they have responsibility to take care of, which I think from a colonial perspective would mean ownership. I think stating that Indigenous people don't own land is not exactly the way to see it, because I think there's this narrative, there's another narrative that non-Indigenous people have when they come to this country. You know, I mean, all the other stereotypes, like we're savages, we, you know, are disrupting colonial economic systems, all of these things, we're lazy. You know, there's a lot of stereotypes that people who are coming from other countries hear about when they come here, that they learn about from white people, that then I hear about, right? And they say, oh, then we learned that that's all not true. It's all lies. And I say, yeah, a great part of Canada was built on lies, was built on the premise that we're not here, that we don't exist, that we were erased, that, and even there's, you know, within that understanding of ownership that we were not here, but also that we just gave up our land because we didn't own it, because we were all living so peacefully and amicably with the settlers that they could just take what they wanted and help themselves to whatever they thought they deserved, because there was no rules, there was no governments, there was no laws. We're a lawless people. We just have protocols. That's not true. Indigenous people, you know, we talk a lot about protocols, but we have laws. We have laws that govern our people that are very strict, that we've upheld and would continue to uphold to this day and have for generations, that have kept our climate in check, that have kept our waters in check, that have kept our men, women, and children in check, that have protected our people for thousands of years. And so it's important to know that Indigenous people have laws and that we have ways of being that butt up against the colonial ways of being, especially when it comes to stupid things like fences, right? And that you somehow need a fence, that you somehow need some sort of, you know, for us, it was, again, all understood in the lens of the hereditary chiefs who took care of those lands. You know, the trails, the grease trails, the forest, the tree line, the patterns of the animals. That's how, you know, that those were our fences. And those ideas of, you know, we're somehow too primitive to understand laws or land ownership still very much so exist today. And episode 5 of the podcast, you can hear how that's unfolding today when Gordon Price, a former city councilor and like some sort of city planner at SFU, is saying basically that we're too primitive to build a sky rise to house our people, right? God. That we don't
Sorry, you have to talk to people saying things like this.
That we are not somehow able to benefit from the wealth of the land in the same ways that colonials are, right? That we're just supposed to be on the shoreline picking clams and tunics, that we're, you know, there's no modernity in our lives, that we, you know, can't live in a way that benefits not just our people, but the population that exists that we share land with today.
Thank you for tuning into our interview with Angela Sterrett. We're going to take a moment here to run a few ads, and when we come back, you'll listen to Angela Sterrett talk about reciprocity and how reciprocal relationships relate to her work within her book and in the Indigenous context, so stay tuned.
Moon River, the collaborative new project from members of the Juno-nominated Indie Folk Mainstays, The Wooden Sky and Linda Ortega, Kathleen Edwards, and Corb Lund's bands, could easily be described as a supergroup of sorts. Not just because of their collective talents, but because the music on their debut album, Volume 1, is simply super. Their knack for creating sonic worlds that are at once lightly trippy and wholly inviting means that as much as they draw on inspirations from decades past, they maintain a pleasing, distinctly out-of-time feel. Described as Buddy Holly meets Krautrock, it's something that you need to hear to fully comprehend. And Vancouverites will have the chance on April 5th at Green Autobody at 1822 Pandora Street, alongside Brandon Wolf Scott and Jody Glenham. Advance tickets are on sale now via Eventbrite for $22.63. So get yours now and mark your calendar to see Moon River live on Friday, April 5th.
Don't
OXA Documentary Film Festival returns May 2nd to 12th, 2024. Audiences of all ages are invited to 10 days of curiosity and critical thought in film. For 22 years, DOXA continues to present both short and feature films from across Canada and the globe, representing some of the best in documentary cinema. This year, DOXA is once again returning to local theaters in Vancouver and will feature live discussions, workshops, and other industry networking events with filmmakers. Visit doxafestival.ca for tickets, and we hope to see you there.
It's Nardwar, the human serviette, and you're listening to Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM at Doo-Doo-Loo-Doo. Doo-Doo.
We have been called the Indians.
Justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
The virus took on many shapes. The bear, the elk, the antelope.
Yeah, you ended your book on a really positive note, and I thought that was really uplifting. I'll just pull a quote that you said. You said, "I cannot wait to see us rise above with each other, not in a Western sense of success, but communally with compassion, curiosity, and courage." And that was on page 238. But this hope and this courage is what keeps communities going. It's what keeps... like, it's what inspires, like, youth from people like you to keep doing the work and to follow what you're doing. And I just wanted to thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. And, yeah, I'm following the footsteps of, like, young people like you, right, who, you know, I think it's so important to listen to the young people. And as a young person who was always, like, I felt like we were always so disenfranchised and not listened to. And, you know, whether it was like, oh, those millennials, what do they want? Or now it's like the Gen X, oh, they're so needy. And it's like, well, maybe they should be. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we should speak about what we need, whether it's mental, emotional, or physical support and help. And maybe we do need to create boundaries and speak up and use our voice. And I learn all the time. My son is 13 now, and I remember when he was 11, he was like, "Mom, you're so out of touch. There's 78 genders." And I was like, 78? And he's like, "Yeah, look it up online. I found a peer-reviewed article." And just, yeah, it's so important for us to listen to young people like you. And so while you might be following my words, I'm following your words and your actions and your leadership skills.
I've heard a lot about in, like, the classes that I'm taking, like, the FNIS classes, is, like, the idea of reciprocal relationships, giving back, but also, like, just kind of, like, being with each other and being present and listening, and also kind of, like, positioning ourselves to, like, be like, okay, well, this is where I'm coming from, but, like, mm-hmm. I'm here. Mm-hmm. Like, what are your kind of thoughts on reciprocal relationships?
Yeah. Do you mind if I share a story around that?
Of course.
So when I did a story about the grandfather and his granddaughter who were arrested and detained while trying to open up her bank account, it became a story that made international headlines overnight. I was doing hits with the BBC, with NPR, all over Canada. It was a huge story to talk about how Indigenous people continue to face racism while just, you know, walking in a store, doing their grocery shopping, banking, trying to get help from police, you know. So the first time I went to Maxwell Johnson, he's the grandfather who was arrested, and Tori, the granddaughter's community of Bella Bella, I was the only reporter there, you know, witnessed the ceremony. I had a camera person there. We interviewed Indigenous people there. We interviewed some folks from BMO who flew a private jet in to participate in the washing ceremony. You know, they were walked around the fire to sort of show their faces that they had done this and that hopefully this mistake would never happen again. It was a washing ceremony, so it was all about taking the trauma that Maxwell and his granddaughter and his nephew had experienced during this heinous, unjust event that happened at the hands of BMO and the VPD. And so while I was there, before I went, I told my boss, I'm going to be getting a gift. I knew this because Maxwell Johnson said, what's your clan, right? And I was like, oh, crap. And I said, oh, crap, because at CBC, there's this notion of, you know, rightly so, impartiality and fairness that we need to attend to, that basically, you know, we don't have a stake in the story as a journalist. We're telling the story and we're not getting anything. You know, it'd be like if an officer gave you some donuts and said, you know, do a good story on me. But there's some stories that don't have another side, right? Mm-hmm. And violence from the police doesn't have another side. Racial profiling doesn't have another side. Racial profiling at a bank doesn't have another side. And all of the institutions admitted this. VPD, the Bank of Montreal, they all, Indigenous Services Canada to a degree, all admitted their wrongdoing in this. So there was no, you know, like, let's dig around and see if, like, racism was justified in this situation or, you know, no, the story was very clear. The bank, the police, and Indigenous Services Canada did Maxwell Johnson and his granddaughter wrong when they detained them while trying to open up her bank account. So I went into my boss's office and I said, I know that I'm getting a gift. And they were like, whoa, whoa, because they were already like, you're in did, like, it, there's this sort of notion that you're already biased by being an Indigenous person telling an Indigenous story. Mm-hmm. Even if the culture and the language and the community is completely different than yours. Somehow we're like all just one big hive mind of Indigenous people in Canada, right? And somehow there's a biases there, which is wrong. You know, I always say, you know, as white reporters, you're doing stories on City Hall all the time. They're all white. You know, there's no discussion about bias there. Anyway, so I'm like, I'm getting a gift. And they're like, whoa, very shocked. And I tried to explain to them, you know, Indigenous notions of reciprocity, this isn't a bribe. This isn't a transactional relationship or an exchange of gifts. It's really a spiritual one of saying, I'm going to tell you the truth to the best of my knowledge, and you're going to tell the truth to me, to the best of your knowledge. It's a spiritual contract. So they said, well, because you're allowed to accept gifts of up to $200. So say you go to a Rogers game and you're going to cover a hockey game and Rogers gives you $200 for a gift of some sort. That's fine. So they said, how much do you think this gift is going to cost? And I said, I don't know, like $200. So I go to the event. And I was right. I went to the floor and Maxwell gifted me a painting, just like I thought he did with my clan on it. It was very beautiful. And I gifted him some of my artwork as well. And I made a point in saying this is a spiritual contract of reciprocity. This is Indigenous ways of knowing and being, which really butts up against colonial ways of knowing and being. And so then I went back to my seat. Then they called me up a second time and said, Angela Sterrett, come down to the floor. I mean, keep in mind, there's like hundreds of people watching. There's my camera person there and all these BMO folks. So I go down a second time and they are standing there, the hereditary chiefs and the matriarchs, and they put a button blanket, a royal blue button blanket over me with an apron. Like, they fully dress me in full regalia. And you can see my face. I'm like so shocked and heartened and just like so honored. But then I'm like, oh, crap, like CBC is going to completely lose their minds about this. Mm-hmm. And so I go back to my office and I tell them, and they're totally losing their minds. And they say, well, how much do you think this button blanket cost? And I'm like, I don't know, like $200, right? As we know, right, button blanket would be like $10,000. And so they completely lose their minds and they say, okay, well, what we're going to do, because the optics of bias are more important than the actual bias. Like, we know that you're not biased telling the story. We know you've done incredible journalism on this. You know, I won like all the awards you could possibly win for the story. I was the only journalist there. Yeah. There was no other journalist there but me. So what they did is they got a white guy to front the entire story. So he sat on the edge of my desk and he got all the scripts for me. I told him what to write. I gave him all my viz, all my interviews, what? Everything. So his name, his face, no. Everything is on the story. And somebody in one of my last events asked me, because they're like, what can I do? And I said, well, speak out. Just yeah. Speak out. And they said, what would have happened if that white reporter would have said something? And I said, I've never thought of that, but that would have changed everything, because he's white and the boss is a white man and they have a lot more credibility in that space than I ever will. And
for now.
for now. I love the hope. You're obviously not a journalist, a jaded journalist. No, I'm just kidding. I love the hope. But if he would have just said, hey, yo, bro, this is wrong. Like, I shouldn't be doing this. Angela should be doing this. Yeah. It would have clicked for him, for the white boss. And they would have possibly allowed me to do my own story, mm-hmm. you know. And this guy didn't get any awards or anything like that. But it was my story yeah. who had a white man's name on it, a white man's face on it. And thank God, not his lens. It was all my material. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, a jarring reality that we live in, where it's a perfect example of colonial notions of give and take, of transaction, yes. of storytelling mm. versus indigenous, which are about reciprocity, collaboration, and connection.
Yeah. Angela, on behalf of the three of us here, as well as Unceded Airwaves, CITR, and beyond, we want to say thank you so much for coming. We really, really appreciate your time, everything that you've shared with us, and we just want to ask if you have any closing remarks.
No, just keep doing all the amazing work that you're doing. Like, I'm so hopeful about the next generation, and I meet so many people, like, you know, in my path as a publisher now, not a publisher, as an author, with my publisher, you know, and my keynotes. And what gives me hope is young people. You know, there's, it's like we have to live in this reality, but we have an option to speak out. We have an option to fight for collective liberation. We have an option to, you know, deconstruct narratives, to dismantle systems. We have an option. We have options. And don't ever let anybody tell you to, you know, this isn't the way of doing things. We have to denormalize. And the way that we do that is by using our voice and continuing to do the work that you all are doing. Yeah. So keep doing it. Just continue to be validated on the path that you're on.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that was our interview with Angela Starrett. Thank you so much for listening. Again, so proud of the members for doing it without me and doing this amazing interview. I really hope you liked it. The next few weeks will be packed with interviews. We have a lot lined up. Next week, you can look forward to hearing our interview with Justice Brokenrope, who is a Lakota vinyl collector, all kinds of Indigenous physical music. He was featured on Future Elders Collective. And if there's one person who I want to see as an elder, it is Justice Brokenrope. Really chill dude. Highly, highly recommend looking up his name, looking up Watika Records, and seeing what he does. So you can stay tuned for that next Monday and next Saturday. Thank you so much for listening.
Masicho.
Hi.
Kukstum Kalup.
Hello, welcome back to Unceded Airwaves. So this is Editing Danny, and we do have about 15 minutes left of our episode. So I'm going to play some of the tracks that we were going to play in our last music episode but didn't have time for. So first you're going to hear Homemaker by Fontaine, then Down to You by Ernest Monius, and then For Dallas by Fawnwood. Thanks for listening.
To be a homemaker, I always wanted to live in the city with the coffee shops and little bars and the sirens and the busy cars. That's all I thought I'd need. I never was somebody's girl, so forgive me if I'm a little scared to give this thing a whirl. But honey, you know that you're making it easy. Oh. Still I'm confused, I've lost myself. Changing it.
to worry. And I know you're out there thinking of me
and you're listening to Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM at Doo-Doo-Loo-Doo.
Doo-Doo.
We have been called the Indians.
Justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
The virus took on many shapes. The bear, the elk, the antelope.
Ever since you went away, hey.